Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
Be as gods, you know, catapult the propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location in a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
Every year in the Nevada desert, there is an event that attracts people from all over the world. It has become somewhat corporate of late, but it is still pagan in its origin, and it seeks nothing less than the fundamental transformation of our society. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is a gentleman who's been watching festivals like this for some time now and has found that there are far more of these out there than we suspect. I imagine if you're listening to this program, we don't travel in the kind of circles that would attend an event like Burning Man, which is, of course, the subject of our conversation, but that's why he watches it, so we don't have to. He's the editor of the currently on hiatus journal Forcing Change, online at forcingchange.org, and that's because he's working on a book forthcoming called Game of Gods, The Temple of Man in the Age of Reenchantment. We welcome back to the program Carl Teichrib. Carl, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me on the program today.
Video for the first time. We finally moved into the 21st century here. Burning Man was taking place over Labor Day weekend here in the United States and the week leading up to it. It is an event that if anyone had wanted to, I suspect could have watched many of the events with streaming video. Because of the lousy internet that we get out in the country, I think, you know, some of the cattle work as satellite uplinks for receivers for our internet hookup. We did not, but I knew that you were on the case, and so I made a point to call, and you've been very gracious with your time today. How long is the event? How many people were there? And just in a nutshell, what is Burning Man?
Well, this was the 30th year of Burning Man. It's been around since 1986. It started off with a burn on a beach, only a handful of people, a few families. Then the following year, it gained in popularity. There was a few more dozen families and people. And within the next year or two, it exploded in popularity, especially after a group in San Francisco called the Cacophony Society found out about it. It made its circle saying, hey, come to the beach. We're going to be burning an effigy. And it got larger. And a few years after the initial burn, the Cacophony Society said, let's haul this idea out to the desert, burn it in the Black Rock Desert of northern Nevada. And it was noted at that point as a place of bohemian living. It was wild. It was uncontrolled. It was anything goes. It was shooting things up, running around naked. It was a free-for-all, and it had an element of just simply, here we are as a community of people who are of like mind, let's do this thing where we will not be bothered by police, bothered by society, where we are doing it on our own. And so it started off just as a small event, but now, I mean, this last week, there was 70,000 people.
70,000?
Yeah, that's right. 70 and three more zeros after that.
Good grief. Trying to think, that's about four or five times more people than we have in our county.
Yeah, it's a big event. It's a city. It literally is a city. It's called Black Rock City. It forms up over the course of a couple of weeks, primarily over the 1 week period of the burn week itself, but a week before. And then also right now, they're still doing cleanups. I mean, as we are talking, doing this interview right now, they're still wrapping up some of the cleanup and some of the other after event activities that need to be done.
Well, it's easy if you just look at the images. You do a search for images through Google or Bing or whatever, and you see a bunch of images, like you said, people, you know, half dressed, running around naked, half naked in the desert, whatever. Is it just a big party, or is there some spiritual point that they're trying to, or goal that they're trying to accomplish with this festival?
There's no real goal. It's not a goal-oriented movement. It's an experience-oriented movement. And there's a difference.
Okay.
This isn't about necessarily we're going to make everybody into burners. There's no hidden agenda in that way. It really, what it is a reflection of the worldview held by society already. Now that's being expressed through art, through culture, through dance, through the experience of this interactive, immersive community, participatory community. It's And I've had people say, well, you know, is there some kind of hidden motive here? Really, if you want to find the hidden motive, go and talk to the people on your block, in your cul-de-sac, in your coffee shop. Find out what their worldview is. You're going to discover that their worldview is, in essence, the worldview that drives events like Burning Man and the many hundreds and hundreds of others that take place around the world every year. In the last 15 years, there's been an explosion of interest in celebration, in festival. And the core here is that this is a place of experience together in community. We feel this oneness together. We feel this energy together. And that's the point. Last year, Derek, I went to a small trance festival in my home province of Manitoba. I did a social survey. I just had paper and a number of questions and interacted with the culture. And over and over again, this sense of we're here to experience this community. It's all about us coming together in celebration, feeling mm-hmm. the oneness. In fact, the theme for that event was Together We Are One. That was the advertising theme that was thrown out for this event.
Hmm. Well, oneness is a word that comes up a lot when you describe this festival. We talked a little earlier for a report on Skywatch TV. What is the significance of that word and of that? What is the meaning behind that word?
The meaning behind the word is really simple. It is the sense that God, man, and nature are intrinsically one. There is no difference. They all share the same essence. They all share the same construct. God, nature, and man are all one. So you have this aspect of oneness, whereas the biblical worldview is the opposite. It says, no, God is not a construct of nature. God is not man. God is distinct, utterly unique, completely different than everything else.
So it almost sounds Eastern.
Oh, absolutely it is. Absolutely. And there's a reason why you see so much Eastern spirituality embedded within these festivals. A lot of them have temples. Lightning in a Bottle has a temple of consciousness. There's a lot of yoga. There's a lot of kundalini. There's a lot of Eastern activity because that is the worldview that we find ourselves living in now. This is a concept of re-enchantment, that we're going back to the earth, back to our inner divine self. It replaces postmodernism, which ultimately has a big question mark at the end of it. Well, what is the meaning of anything? There is no truth. Postmodernism ultimately says that there is a void of meaning. We disregard the Christian narrative. We have put aside the materialist narrative, and now what? There's nothing. We're not really sure what's going on. It's a great big void, and that's what postmodernism really has always been, just this void. At the same time, and I bring this up in my book, at the same time that postmodernism came into play in the 1960s, re-enchantment was already in motion as well, and that is no. No, there is an answer. There is a meaning. There is some other reality here that's not Christian, that's not materialist. It is back to the earth. It is back to the Eastern worldview. It is back to nature. It is back to this oneness. And so the idea of re-enchantment is what comes after postmodernism? Paganism.
So the folks like Dawkins are really in for a big disappointment. Post-Christian.
I'm glad you brought that up, because even within secular circles, and especially as I've interacted with some of the transhumanist community, there is a strong recognition. My friend Lincoln Cannon has brought this up.
Yeah.
There's a strong recognition that there is a type of spirituality, and that the secularist hypothesis that there is no spirituality at all. Well, it's gone. It's aged. It's vaporizing, as even the secularists are now looking for something that is spiritual, which is why organizations like Pew Research now have to ask the question, are you spiritual, in their polls as they do their religious studies? Because they realize that culturally, we've accepted differences. We're no longer religious. We're spiritual.
And because it's all based on experience, that can mean just about anything.
Right, exactly. And I've asked this of people. I says, well, what do you mean when you say You know, I'm spiritual, but not religious. What do you mean? You did yoga until something snapped. You toked up until, you know, you got a vision. What in the world do you mean? What you typically end up finding out, and I've said this in some of my conference talks, is that you really don't want to commit to any truth claim that's going to put you into a corner or paint a picture.
Mm. So the Christian worldview is that there are certain doctrines, truths that were revealed to the prophets and to the apostles by God himself. God, right, through revelation to the apostles and through the prophets, and then to the apostles through direct teaching from Jesus Christ, God in the flesh. These doctrines have been written down, codified to some extent. We moved through a postmodern era where it was all about feeling or you know, where there's a question, is there any truth? And now we're moving into an area of experience where truth is just how you feel.
Yeah, that's a part of it. It's not that postmodernism goes away. It's now that postmodernism is being absorbed into the sense of we now are looking for a larger truth. And that larger truth can't be Christian, and it can't be secularist. So what else is left?
Hmm.
What else is left?
Yeah, it's
pagan. That's really all that's left.
Hmm.
And so postmodernism is never going to really disappear, but it is morphing. It is changing. And it is accepting the sense that my duty now is to the earth. My duty now is to the cosmos. We have to evolve together. We have to move forward. There is a purpose to all of this. Hmm. And the purpose is the evolution of humanity into deity.
Okay. Eventually moving toward apotheosis.
Right.
You're trying to make sense of this can really be, it would seem to me, frustrating. Sort of like to borrow a phrase that I thought I'd heard somewhere else, and I actually read it in a book from, late great planet Earth, Hal Lindsey, 25 years ago, that it, you know, trying to figure out the doctrine of a certain group that he was writing against. It's like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. That would seem to kind of describe the sense of getting a handle on a movement that doesn't have any written doctrines where it means whatever, however you feel today is what it means. How do you make sense of this, Carl?
well, what it means is, first of all, as Christians, we need to understand that that's the way that they are thinking. I've had so many people say, well, you know, let's just storm this place. In fact, I had a conversation not that long ago with somebody saying, well, we need to, you know, we need to come against this and stand up against this. And I have friends who go to Burning Man as Christians witnessing. And there is a special way you do this. It's a special kind of place, a special kind of worldview. And again, it's the same worldview that your neighbors hold. But what the last thing that we need to do is go there and reinforce the negative stereotypes they already have of Christians.
Right. You make yourself
can't go there with bullhorns.
You make yourself a stumbling block.
Bingo. And so what you end up having to do is you really have to boil this down to a personal level and talk to people individually. You have to make this an example to them where our Christianity is something more than just simply the visions that they have, the false assumptions that they may have. One of my friends, when he goes to Burning Man, him and his crew will take bottles of water and car jacks, because as 70,000 people are leaving Burning Man, you've got people with flat tires, you've got people with trouble on the road, and they're there serving them.
Mm.
And they're serving them and they're helping them out. And people ask, well, why are you doing this? Well, we're Christians. And they don't hide that. And in fact, they tell them, this is why we are Christians and this is what Christians do. And they're like, well, we had a different idea of what Christians do. And it opens up that conversation where they can bring Jesus Christ into it in a way that is tangible and real.
Mm.
And so that's the approach that, and again, Derek, there's only literally a handful of people doing that.
Right, right.
You know, that's all there is.
And, you know, it seems to me that that's an approach that we ought to take with a number of different groups, at least the ones that aren't actively trying to shoot us while we're trying to approach them. But I say that somewhat tongue in cheek, but there are a number of groups out there that we tend to approach with you know, fire and brimstone. And like I said, we basically become the obstacle between them and Jesus Christ. And so
Absolutely.
We need to watch that.
And I saw this firsthand where this worked. a wonderful way when I was at the Parliament of World Religions last year. There was other Christians there who were going in as ambassadors for Christ. They paid their way in. And for those who want to go to Burning Man and do witnessing, you better pay your way in. You're not going to be jumping the fences to go witness. It isn't going to work like that. And they were there interacting one-on-one, giving the gospel and talking and asking people, okay, what do you believe? Mm-hmm. And opening up that conversation. The other option would have been to stand on the steps with bullhorns and pickets, and you would have done absolutely nothing for the cause of Christ except become the stumbling block. Mm.
What are some of the other festivals that are out there? I know there was another one that was recent I paid some attention to called Tomorrowland, which was happening at multiple venues around the country. What are some of the other major events out there? And again, in what direction are they trying to push us?
I'll back up just briefly. Tomorrowland, Burning Man, Lightning in a Bottle, so many of these other events. Sonic Bloom in California or in Colorado. I believe Interfuse is just a little bit north of you in south central Missouri. Mm-hmm. So many of these events are a little different one from the other. They're not the same. They're not cookie cutters. And all of them fit within this broad scope called transformational festivals or evolutionary culture. And you could fit in pagan events like pagan spirit gatherings, Starwood. You could put in some of the mythologically oriented events like Fairy World. And there's a whole fairy genre of festivals out there. Tennessee's Pagan Unity Festival. Huh. There's dozens and dozens. There's hundreds. You can't list them all. In fact, I've been working on a Google Map project pinning festival locations, and I have 280 right now for Canada and the U.S.
Wow, for just Canada and the U.S.
Yes.
Wow.
Correct. And I still have about 50 or so to vet out, and another 50 or so to include. And I know that there's more yet. Nonetheless, okay, this gives you the idea that this is a broad movement. It's not just simply one event or one style. So Tomorrowland, let's go back to Tomorrowland. Tomorrowland is a concert venue, an EDM, electronic dance music, concert venue. It's not necessarily a festival like Burning Man at all. It's different. It's a concert, a multi-day, multi-stage, multi-performer festival. But why I would include Tomorrowland in it, in this idea of transformational festivals or evolutionary culture, is because from beginning to end, it has its own mythos. It creates its own mythos. It creates its own legend. The legend is built around the evolution of your consciousness. Between stages, between performers, the stage itself is coming alive and preaching to you, you are all one. We are all united together. We are all one world in harmony, feeling together. Hmm. And so at that level, it already enters the foray of being transformational. It's no longer looking at the traditional sense of reality. It's looking at this new construct of reality, this idea here again of oneness.
As an observer of the human condition for most of my adult life, both as a broadcaster and then in sales, which requires you to be somewhat to have some ability to read other people and respond to their needs, try to anticipate their needs and serve them. It would seem to me that this idea of oneness is falsifiable on its face. How do the organizers of these festivals explain away the fact that the one thing humanity's been getting better and better at with each passing generation is killing more and more of each other? I mean, if we're all one, why do we keep stabbing ourselves?
Because we're all not enlightened yet.
I see. Ha, ha.
There's a lot of aspects of falsification.
Yeah.
Number one, what happens when there is a worldview that is diametrically opposed, that is so different, so other than oneness oriented, that it can never be included within your oneness worldview? Right. The very fact that that exists demonstrates that there's a problem with oneness.
Right. Right.
It will never subsume into it.
Yeah. And so
the Christian worldview is that worldview, and it will not, it cannot subsume into the oneness.
I would argue that you could make the same claim about Judaism or Islam for the same, you know, by the same token. But
right.
it seems to me that there is a certain mindset out there that is incapable of, just immune to cognitive dissonance, because the ideas are, as you say, they're mutually incompatible. And yet that seems to be, what happens then? How do they achieve oneness when you've got these religious beliefs that are, as you say, diametrically opposed? I mean, you cannot assimilate right. a Christian worldview into this concept of oneness.
Yeah, but you're looking at it, Derek, from a Western point of view. You're looking at it from the point of view of your Judeo-Christian background.
Right, yeah.
In the Eastern worldview, you can hold opposites.
Yeah, I've heard Ravi Zacharias mention that, but he said even there in India, where we're used to doing this, we still look both ways before we cross the street.
Absolutely, of course, of course.
It is either me or it is the bus.
And you don't want to be one with the grill of the bus.
Exactly. So again, it's demonstrably false, and yet...
Of course. Well, there is a feeling here, though, and I stress this word over and over again. There is a feeling that comes with this false sense of being one with everything. There is a tangible physical feeling. I have felt that feeling and recognize it for what it is. And it doesn't seem to matter. And this is where things get a little bit wonky, a little bit weird. You can have that feeling if you're in a secular concert venue where the power and the emotion and the energy of the place just grabs you. You can have that feeling standing on a mountaintop or looking over the Grand Canyon or seeing an incredible sunset. You can have that feeling, and I've been in pagan circles and pagan settings. They're definitely expressing and feeling that there. Mm-hmm. Here's where it gets kind of scary. You have the same feeling in church services.
Yeah, yeah.
And I bring this up in my book. I have to ask Christians the question, is your basis of reality, is your faith found on your feelings? Or is Jesus Christ the same yesterday and today and forever, regardless of how you feel?
Hmm. I'm glad you went in that direction, because I was going to ask, is this sense of connectedness, this emotional... How did you put it in the note here? Emotional catharsis, so powerful that it overwhelms reason.
Right. And it does. It does. It becomes an emotive state. And I've seen this. I've seen this firsthand. I've seen this where it overwhelms and there's weeping. There's this incredible sense of, now this is real. I'm feeling it. How can you argue with what I feel? A great example was on Sunday evening. Saturday night, of course, was the burn. And if you'd watched the live feed of the burn, and a lot of people have misgivings, I'm not going to watch the burn. I'm not going to watch the live feed. Folks, the live feed of the burn is a camera set up on a high vantage point. You see nothing in detail. You've got commentators speaking, and they're often far more lewd than anything else sometimes you may hear, especially with their Burning Man information radio, because it's a very open platform. But the actual feed itself shows you what's happening on a large scale, a panorama setting. It's not like they're focusing in on the guy walking nude across the desert, you know? Mm-hmm. So people have a little bit of misgivings. I'm not going to watch this because of those kinds of situations. What's interesting is on Saturday evening, when you watch the burn and the man burns, it's an incredible display of fireworks and pyrotechnics and fire and flame and smoke. It is amazing. There is no question about it. It is a spectacle of fire, and it is celebratory. There's cheering. There's fire drummers. There's conclaves. It really has that sense of, here is this energy, this primordial energy, as the man is burning. Well, that's Saturday night. Sunday night, when they burned the temple, and this year's temple was a 5-story structure, approximately 100 feet high, with a 50 by 50 foot space, interior space, with altars set up in it. When they burned the temple, and the temple has become the heart and soul, really, of Burning Man. Mm-hmm. When they burned the temple, it's not celebratory. It's not wild. It's not crazy. It's not fireworks. It's 70,000 people in silence.
Hmm.
Weeping, crying, in silence, completely introspective, watching what they have done over the course of the week, most of it laying down their heart and soul in this temple, posting notes, pictures of loved ones, people who have passed away, writing notes, expressing themselves, their innermost feelings, their innermost experiences, their emotions, their longings, expressing this at the temple all week long, and then they burn it. Hmm. And the difference between the two nights is so stark. It is palpable. You can tell the difference between those two nights. And you realize that one is just simply the party. Mm-hmm. That's all that is. It's the party. The other is this intense spiritual feeling, this intense emotional release. And you can't argue with that because it's not that that didn't happen. That experience is there. Mm. Now, whether it's grounded in an ultimate reality is a different question.
Yeah.
But the experience and the feeling is there.
Hmm. And sadly, this is the kind of thing that is leading to some aberrant practices within the Christian church, especially in the hyper-charismatic movement. The feeling trumps doctrine.
Right, right.
And this, when you've got people who have no doctrine on which to base, to use as a framework for their feelings. And that's not to say that feelings in a church service are necessarily a bad thing or
right.
or illegitimate, but you've got to check those against doctrine, which is why Jesus told us to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, your soul, and your mind. Heart and mind in
right.
at the same time. This sounds an awful lot like the cremation of care ceremony at the Bohemian Grove.
It is. There is this interplay, Derek, and it's a powerful, powerful interplay. And that's why in my book that's coming up, part of the subtitle is Reenchantment, because this is a magical moment now. This is a point in time where we are back in touch with this spirituality that we have left way off in the ancient time, in the dust of ancient history, and are reanimating it, which is one of the reasons why even in my book, I talk about some of the political events I've attended. Right now, this morning, I was working through my chapter talking a little bit about the World Urban Forum that I took part in 2006 in Vancouver, British Columbia. This was a United Nations event for working around the idea of what global cities do and what global citizenship looks like. Well, part of that event, and by the way, I think our first day we had like 12,000 people. It was a huge, huge, huge global event. Mm-hmm. It was a United Nations forum. Mm-hmm. On the Wednesday, June the 21st, the forum had a cultural side event where they burnt a 14-foot effigy to an Indonesian-based demon goddess.
Okay.
And that was the opening of their solstice celebration, and then they did an Earth solstice dance all night. Okay, this is a political venue.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, this is about talking about city infrastructure and working between cities and the international community, and we had representatives from the World Bank and the IMF, and all we had mayors from major cities who'd flown all over the world to this event. And we're burning a 14-foot effigy to a demon goddess.
That's, this is what Reverend Dr. Robert Bennett writes about in his books on spiritual warfare and demon possession. His most recent book is called Afraid, and he deals with this particular topic here in the United States. It said American Christians, and of course his book's a little more narrowly focused, I think, on Christians who don't recognize what's going on in the culture around them, are participating in events like this because they perceive them as cultural rather than as right. spiritual. But what you're describing are people who understand that these are spiritual events and weighing in because they're finding some meaning in them that they are not getting elsewhere.
Right.
What is your sense of the groups that participate in events like Burning Man and Tomorrowland? Mm. Are they coming from pagan backgrounds? I mean, they can't be, can they? I mean, these have to be a lot of people who came from generations of at least nominal Christians, right?
Yes. In fact, this is, Derek, why I think it's important that there's more research done on the ground. As far as I know, I'm the only Christian that's tackled the concept of transformational festivals in a broad global approach.
Right.
Other Christian writers have tackled Burning Man specifically. But until 2013, I don't think anybody else had ever tackled this from that global perspective. And the reason I tackled it from that global perspective is because I realized that there's a global political movement. I've been a part of that. I've watched that intimately. There's a global interfaith movement. When I was at the Parliament of World Religions, I saw that intimately. If we have politics, we have religion, there are other aspects of this too. There also has to be a cultural element. And that's what forced me to look at this beyond Burning Man and see that there is something bigger than just that one event, that this is a cultural expression. And we don't get it. The Christian community doesn't get it. They think that that this is just something that's happening outside of their neighborhood. It isn't a part of their world. But really it is. It's like I said, it's their neighbors. It's their families. I've had time after time when I've given my talks on transformational festivals. I gave one 2 years ago when I was at Colorado Springs. And this year I mentioned it in one of my talks. Again, I had people come up to me, even though I just mentioned it, saying, yeah, that's my son. That's my daughter. You know, in fact, I had a great conversation with a lady who was a performer at Burning Man and has been to Burning Man while we were at the Colorado conference just a month and a half ago, Derek.
Really?
Not even, whenever that was, in the end of July when we were in Colorado.
I would think that Venn diagram of Burning Man attendees and Prophecy Conference attendees would be a pretty small circle, right. A pretty small overlap there.
Right. But you know, what's interesting was when I gave that talk 2 years ago, she approached me and said, hey, let's talk. I'm a burner or an ex-burner. She's no longer a burner.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, okay, this is not something that's distant. Not when you have literally 280 events in Canada and the US alone, it's not distant anymore. Mm-hmm. Sorry. One of the questions I had on my questionnaire, that I did when I was at the festival I attended last year was, mark, philosophical and religious identifiers, past and present, mark or number, if multiple, and where applicable, write out the branch or divisions. And I've got atheist, agnostic, animist, Baha'i, the list goes on and on of religions that you could mark. Of those people who filled out my forms, my surveys, half of those who had marked down a religious persuasion, half of those identified as past Christian.
Oh.
And as they were talking amongst each other, answering my surveys, they're talking about what youth groups they would go to, what churches they attended. So I knew at that point, okay, you're not just cultural Christians. You identify as past Christians. Half of those I surveyed who said they were religious were of a Christian background and have rejected Christianity and have now accepted. I even have on the list Taoism, Spiritism, even transhumanism. And I've had people marking down transhumanism. I reject Christianity. I'm now a transhumanist. I've got one. I'd have to dig it up. But I've got one where I think one lady put down like five different religious possibilities after she walked away from Christianity, including Buddhism and Wiccan, transhumanism, the list goes on. Okay, these are your kids.
Mm-hmm.
These are your church kids.
What are we doing that's turning them to events like this?
I think one of the things we're doing is we're not taking our own faith seriously. We're taking our we're playing a lot of church, and we're not allowing the reality of what it means to be a follower of Christ to come through. And that reality is not a list of do's and don'ts. Do's and don'ts may come into it. They do, because there's a moral imperative, an ethical imperative that comes. But first of all, we don't even know who it is that we worship. We have the sense that he is just simply our friend or something else. And he is. He's our friend, but he is so much more. Yeah. We have lost the fear of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we lose the fear of God, even as Christians, we replace him with all kinds of other things. And I think part of it is we have walked away from a strong Christian intellectual discourse. We've walked away from Christianity's walked away from the arts completely. We've walked away from culture. We've walked away from everything. And now we're somehow surprised that it's not Christian anymore and our kids are running to this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we lost by default because we weren't in the game.
Mm. There are, elements within Christianity in America that argue that we need to take back the seven mountains of culture and the seven or spheres of influence in culture. And while I disagree that God has made that an imperative,
right?
But it certainly helps explain. We certainly would have a lot more impact on the culture if people who were in business were trying to impact the area, maybe not dominate it, and certainly not using, because I'm doing this for God, you know, any means necessary are acceptable.
Wrong approach.
But certainly influencing the mountain on which you are, the mountain you're climbing is certainly what we should be doing. If they can't tell you're a Christian when you're interacting with the world, then you're doing something wrong. You're not doing it right.
Right. I think the difference, and we have to be careful with this because you're right, in terms of the Seven Mountain Mandate and that whole movement, you're opposed, I'm opposed to it because I believe ultimately their perspective is skewed.
Right. They believe that it's an imperative. We need to take over the world because Jesus is stuck at the right hand of God until we make all of his enemies a footstool beneath his feet. Hey, newsflash, read the New Testament. That's already happened.
Exactly. But I think, though, where this conversation is important is that we as Christians, in distancing ourselves from culture and distancing ourselves from our neighbors and distancing ourselves from society because mm-hmm. we quote unquote, don't want to be tainted. Well, guess what? We're tainted already. We're just simply saved.
Right.
And yet we're still broken pots of clay.
Right.
By distancing ourselves from culture, it's not that we have just simply abandoned culture. We've abandoned people.
Mm-hmm.
And when we abandon people, when we abandoned our voice in those areas, I mean, yeah, well, see, what else do you expect them to do? I also have talked to parents who've had issues internally with their own family, and their sons or daughters have now jumped into this movement because there's heartbreak, there's problems right within the family structure itself, and they realize that first of all they have to get their own house in order, and we really do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would suggest there's ways to approach this culture. One example, I have a cousin who goes to church in Australia. Her church in Australia buys a booth inside the New Age Festival, which comes, I believe it's in Brisbane. They buy a booth, literally. They pay the money. They're there. And that way they can't get kicked out. And they have Christian literature on the table and material specifically aimed at the New Age movement. And they are not in there banging on drums and blowing bullhorns and with picket signs. They're there quietly, calmly, lovingly, mm-hmm. bringing the truth to people. And they've had people come to Christ because of that.
Yeah. I would suggest another example is Guy Malone's Ancient of Days UFO Festivals, which took place during the annual UFO festivals at Roswell, New Mexico, where you've got a lot of seekers who are looking for answers in extraterrestrials. And he was there as a Christian dressed up as something from outer space, but bringing the message. I mean, he even got to organize one of the festivals one year for the city of Roswell, which is pretty incredible when you think about it.
I
think you're right. If we try to hide ourselves within an enclave or a compound, we cannot be salt and light if we have placed walls between us and the rest of the world. How is there a danger, do you think, of this de-emphasis of doctrine in our churches? We talked before the program here about some things that I've been working on and things that I'm finding among academics who are secular that relate to ancient cosmology, which certainly the prophets and apostles would have been familiar with. The mythology of the Greeks and Romans, they weren't just great stories to be converted into cartoons by Disney 2,000 years down the road. That was their religion.
Right.
They believed it. They sacrificed to it. Sometimes they sacrificed other people to it. But that's, their worldview was shaped by the gods. And this, going all the way back to ancient Sumer, ancient Mesopotamia, and the Israelites came out of that. God chose his people out of that. They were right smack in the middle of all of that. And they were aware of all of this stuff. And they understood that the spiritual war, supernatural war, was real. That it was God versus the gods, Yahweh versus the gods. We have lost that in the Christian church. And for 1500 or 1600 years, since the time of Augustine or thereabouts, we have desupernaturalized the Bible to the point where we say we believe in a deity who spoke the universe into in existence, and his son who lived among us, died, and rose again 3 days later. But all of that was 2000 years ago. Now I just want to know how to live my best life now. How much of this, the rise of this return to paganism, is a result of us losing this narrative of the spiritual war taking place around us?
I think it has a lot to do with it. I think it has a lot to do with the loss of a type of Christian intellectualism that really seemed to disappear after Francis Schaeffer. I mean, Francis Schaeffer played a remarkable role in reinvigorating the sense that intellectualism and Christianity, they do go hand in hand, and they do answer to our culture. They do answer to our society. And we have lost a lot of that. And we've also de-emphasized, like you said, the spiritual element of it. We've de-emphasized it in a significant way. And this is not to say that we need to go looking for demons behind every bush.
No, no.
But we also realize that we serve a supernatural God, and we are also supernatural beings. We are engaged in a supernatural conflict here. And there's a worldview that circles around this. The other side gets that. And that's why they are gravitating to things like, you could call it the re-enchantment of the world, where we are now re-deifying ourselves, we re-deify nature, we open our arms up to the ancient worldview, because that's what's happening. They are opening up their arms to that ancient worldview. I look at what Paul did in Acts 17, and I think there's a model for us, and I've said this in many of my talks. Acts 17 really is a model for how to handle a pagan culture. Paul, when he went to Mars Hill, he didn't go in ignorance. He understood the worldview of the pagans well enough. He could quote their own philosophers, quote their own poets. He leveraged their worldview to open up a discussion of the true God, Jesus Christ, the nature of man, and redemption and sin and salvation. But he understood the worldview. He didn't go in there closed, you know, with eyes closed. He went in there fully aware of it and able to leverage it. And I see what we're going to have to do as Christians, as we are entering an age of re-enchantment. Burning Man's a great example of that. As we are entering an age of re-enchantment, we'll have to understand those worldviews. We don't need to understand them in and out completely, but enough so that we can at least begin to ask questions that open up conversations, like what Paul did.
There was a gentleman I knew, he's since passed away, but he came out of the New Age movement, and he had some pretty remarkable experiences to tell about his time in Haight-Ashbury in the Summer of Love back in 67, where he saw a guy actually manifest in front of him, you know, turn into a luminous being right in front of his eyes. And he said, I wasn't on anything, at least not that night. but I wonder if you might have put your finger on it when you said the other side gets it. They understand that they're in a conflict, whereas we do not. What this fellow said, his name is David Duncan. And if listeners want to go back and look in the archives early on, PID Radio and A View from the Bunker, to some of the interviews we did with David Duncan, they were very, very educational, said that they view Christians as people who practice a form of magic, but it's a very weak form of magic. And most Christians don't even understand that that's what they're doing in the first place. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not an accurate representation of what we're doing.
Right.
Prayer
right.
is not an incantation.
Right.
But that's how they view the conflict, and they understand that it's a conflict. We have been so conditioned by the English word God, small g God, and the danger that we might drift into polytheism, that we avoid any understanding that these spiritual entities that have rebelled against Yahweh are, in fact, gods. They are worshipped by other people. In the Bible, God calls them gods. So I'm pretty, you know, sure I'm on safe ground here by using that word. But if only one side in the war understands that there's a fight going on,
right.
the other side doesn't got a chance. And that seems to me that there's an awful lot of us on this side of the line that don't understand that we're being shot at.
Right, right. I think part of our response is when we understand that this is a spiritual worldview collision point. I think one of the things we need to realize is that there is a fundamental difference between Christianity and everything else. All other forms of religion, occultism, magic, the New Age, even if you want to go into the secularist religions of secularist humanism and atheism, all of it demands that there are techniques to manipulate the supernatural or the natural world. It is always a technique. You're looking for a technique. Magic is about a technique.
Yeah.
The occult is about a supernatural technique. When you're engaged in yoga, you're engaged in a spiritual technique.
Right.
All of this is technique-driven. Whereas Christianity says, and this is where we don't have the magic powers because we don't, Christianity says it's not about you and your technique. It's about Christ and his one-time technique, right. And that's all that's required.
That's a good way of putting it. I like this too, this term. I've written it down to use it again. Spiritual worldview collision point. Final question. I think there's probably a number of us of parental and soon someday grandparental age who would think that the solution to this problem is to tell our kids, you can't go. That's it. You're staying home. You're not leaving the house, young lady, that sort of thing. How much of these, the growth of these festivals is because there is a spiritual push to promote this worldview, and how much of it is, and I think I know the answer to your question, but I just want to summarize this. How much of this is a result of changes that have already taken place in the culture? In other words, is it the cause of the shift, or is the shift resulting in the growth of these festivals?
The shift is resulting in the growth of these festivals.
Okay.
Yeah. These festivals are a manifestation of the worldview that your son and daughter already hold.
A symptom, not the cause.
That's right. And we need to keep that in mind. By the way, the demographics is not just youth. Tomorrowland and the trans festival stuff, a lot of that can be. But Burning Man, you've got people from every demographic walk of life. Same with the festival I went to last year. I was one of the older ones there, but there were people older than myself. That's for certain.
Yeah. Well, when you look at, say, the 60s, which is when American society culture really kind of stood on its head. We're a couple of generations down the road from there, so...
What's interesting with the 60s, Derek, is in this culture, this transformational festival culture recognizes the 60s was their starting point, but they also know the 60s was an era of feeling around in the dark, unable to truly understand what it was that they were doing. Now they know what they're doing, and there's a difference. Mm.
Carl Tykrib is the author of the forthcoming book, Game of Gods, the Temple of Man in the Age of Reenchantment. We're smack in the middle of it. And, of course, the website forcingchange.org still available online with 9 years' worth of archives of the excellent Forcing Change Journal. Carl, we really appreciate your work, and I appreciate you taking so much time out of your schedule this afternoon.
Hey, thanks for letting me be on the program today, Derek. We will talk to you down the road.
Amen. You'll find the show notes both on the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert, and at vftb.net, vftb.net. Of course, the link will take you to Carl's website, forcingchange.org, and we are eagerly looking forward to reading his book, Game of Gods, as soon as it's available, and we'll have him back. We'll likely have him on Skywatch TV as well to talk about that as soon as it's available. In the news this week, of course, the big news here in the U.S., because we just, you know, navel-gazed, pay attention to what happens here more than anywhere else, was the debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, which had... Super Bowl-like numbers, 84 million viewers tuned in to watch. Lester Holt took a lot of criticism from conservatives. Frankly, I think he did a good job. It was a difficult, thankless task because no matter which candidate he got tough on, the partisans for that candidate were going to jump all over him. I thought he did a pretty good job of keeping things moving along when both candidates insisted on continuing down a certain path. He did it without getting rude. It's not a job I would ever want, frankly, because, again, you're not going to come out of that looking good to about half of the viewing audience, whatever you do. Who won? Well, I think it depends on who you supported going into the debate. There are some who thought that Hillary won the debate, even though they are Trump supporters. But I think as long as Trump didn't make any serious errors, which he didn't, he really came out ahead. It's like in baseball, you know, tie goes to the runner. I think in this case, it was close enough that you could flip a coin. And I think the difference between the candidates is determined by the passion of their supporters. Trump's supporters are a lot more passionate about him than Hillary's supporters are for her. That's just all there is to it. The conservative base, which is not to be confused with the Republican Party base, as we've seen this year, is a lot more excited about Donald Trump than the Democratic base is about Hillary. That's just a fact. And I think that is going to be the deciding factor in the election in November. Barack Obama won primarily because people were more excited about him on the Democratic side, the progressive side, than conservatives were for either John McCain or Mitt Romney, which is understandable because neither one of those men is really a conservative. So Republicans faced with no other choice, you know, the proverbial hold your nose and cast your ballot type thing. This year, there are a lot of Republicans in name who are turned off by Trump's brash approach, but he's saying the things that need to be said. We need to secure our borders. We need to disentangle from pointless military adventures overseas that are draining our economy. And we need to reconfigure trade deals so that we stop gutting the middle class of the of America. The American middle class is shrinking. And because I tend not to believe that our government is made up of stupid people, that takes more faith than believing that they're doing this on purpose, that they're lying to us, in other words. I think government policies have been shaped by globalists who want to eliminate that pesky American middle class because we're just a little too ornery and independent for our own good, in their view. So if Mr. Trump delivers on his promises, and I'm not sure that he can, he may try, but I'm not sure that he can, the average American stands to gain a lot more from a Trump presidency than a Clinton presidency, because we've already seen what Hillary will do. Just pay attention to what she promoted when she was in the White House as First Lady and what she did when she was Secretary of State. She will continue the wars in the Middle East. In fact, I thought it was interesting and significant that the elite-controlled media, New York Times, Washington Post, and so on, and the Washington Post, by the way, they have gotten so annoying since Jeff Bezos of Amazon purchased the newspaper. I have two Kindles at home, a Kindle Fire HDX 7-inch and a 9-inch, which I inherited the bigger one when Sharon found an iPad Air at a really great price. And I like them both. They're great pieces of hardware as far as their specs. Frankly, and screen resolution, they're right up there with the iPad, but they're at a fraction of the price. But Amazon always preloads the Washington Post app onto the Kindle, which is great marketing. I mean, it's a smart move for Amazon to do, but they are so far in the tank for Hillary Clinton. I finally had to delete the app because there is no objective media. I think that is a misconception that's been perpetrated on the American public over the years by the press. They want us to believe that they're, and I was part of the mainstream media for a while. Okay. I got my start in radio as a rookie newsman and got to see up close as an intern for one of the big Chicago stations, what the newspaper and television reporters and the other radio reporters did when they were covering a story, and how what they saw at the story, and even as a 20-year-old kid, I could see this, didn't match what I saw when I was at the story. I mean, for some of these reports that I was at the event, it's like, was this guy even in the same zip code? That was a very, very educational. But it took a while before I really realized that, it wasn't just my lack of experience shaping my views there. That's exactly what goes on. The objective media has never been objective in this country. Go back and if you just feel like it sometime, just start digging around on the web and you can, I'm sure, find archives of old, old newspapers. Like I'm talking like War of 1812, and look at how they reported and the partisan reporting that went on through the War of 18, through the Civil War, things like that. There has never really been an objective press in the U.S. That this is a myth that has been perpetrated over the last couple of generations. CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, the newspapers, they all have a point of view. The key to getting the most out of the news is just understanding what their point of view is and factoring that into how you read or see or hear the story. Anyway, the Washington Post just got so blatant and so obnoxious about it that they've been deleted off my my Kindles. Anyway, the perception, I think, of who won this debate really depended on who you supported going into the debate. Neither side really landed a knockout punch. There are things that, in sales terms, Donald Trump could have done differently. He left money on the table in sales terms because there are things that he could have done differently. But I think as Christians, we need to remember that we shouldn't get caught up in the show. And really, this is the show. It's a circus. It is reality television, which in part is why Mr. Trump is doing so well. This is the way we select our leaders now, and so we get what we deserve. Ever since the Kennedy-Nixon debate, I think, when PR wonks figured out that it really didn't matter. It didn't matter as much what you said in the debate as it as how you said it and how you looked when you said it. Because Nixon, who was not experienced in front of a camera and didn't have the natural charm and good looks of John F. Kennedy, to the people who only heard the debate on the radio, won the debate. But the people who watched on camera and saw him sweating and, you know, some of the other physical tics that Richard Nixon had, Kennedy was the winner. And so that has shaped the presidential selection process ever since. And that's why we're subjected to these debates that don't really inform us on what the candidates think about specific topics. It's a show. It is like playoff baseball. So don't get too caught up in it. Remember, whoever sits in the White House after Inauguration Day in January, we Christians still have a higher calling, which is our prime directive to make disciples of all nations. Do your due diligence and vote as a good citizen. You know, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. But let's not trust in Trump for salvation, because that's just not going to happen. That's just not going to happen. The world is sliding into an alternate reality anyway. And the Bible told us this would happen, a great falling away, a great apostasy. The enemy, and I'm talking principalities and powers here, not other humans, is hard at work trying to deconstruct God's design for humanity. Talked about that on the last program just a little bit. Another data point to consider now in Norway, which is a fairly wealthy, you know, progressive, very secular society, not much left of the Christian faith in Norway. You can now legally change your gender just by going online and clicking your mouse on a form. And if you've got parental consent, you can do it even when you're a child. That's all it takes. Doesn't matter what your DNA looks like. Doesn't matter what your reproductive organs look like. You can just now determine whether you are male or female simply by clicking your mouse. We are going over the cliffs of insanity. In London, the London Sperm Bank has reduced the process of childbearing to a virtual trip to the Build-A-Bear workshop. You can select a donor, a sperm donor, that is, for your child if you're a single woman, by selecting for certain character traits. You can look at, you know, the identity of the donor is kept secret, but you can select your donor on the basis of job history, income history, personal characteristics. Is he musical? Does he smoke? Is he tall? You know, whatever. They don't say that doing this is virtual eugenics. I suppose they would make the argument that when we select a spouse, a mate, or even just a sexual partner, we're in a sense practicing eugenics of a sort by selecting that partner on the basis of certain desired characteristics. But this takes it to a whole nother level where you don't even have to see the other person. You just tap, 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 tap. You can even set up a certain search algorithm that sends you an instant notification as soon as a donor meeting your search criteria arrives at the London Sperm Bank. And of course, since you don't need a man to be present there, they're calling this app Buy a Daddy. Order a Daddy, is what it's being called. Again, eugenics in a smartphone app is what it is. And it's just another little drip, drip, drip in this Chinese water torture wearing away at the definition of what it means to be human. Because we don't need two parents anymore. In fact, you don't even need two partners anymore to have a child. Just place your order through your smartphone. We'll send you a text. Come on in when it's convenient to you. And there you are. Of course, this can lead to some interesting complications. There was a story from within the past year of two women who were partners, wanted to have a child together, went to a sperm bank, didn't get what they thought they were paying for. The child was born with a lot more melanin in the skin than these two Caucasian women expected, and so they filed a lawsuit. Of course, progressives then began to have heads explode as cognitive dissonance overwhelmed their brains because they don't want to criticize the, you know, two lesbians having a child, but at the same time, they don't want, they can't accept the fact that they're two white women who are suing because they've got a black child. You know, how do you criticize the one without criticizing the other? So anyway, it's, again, the enemy trying to deconstruct God's design for the family. In the Middle East, an interesting development, Israel and Jordan have signed a massive deal to supply natural gas from the Leviathan gas field that Israel controls in the eastern Mediterranean. It's a $10 billion deal. It makes Israel the largest energy supplier to the country of Jordan, the Hashemite Kingdom. Israel becoming an energy power, or at least a player. The next step, they're going to try to lay a pipeline to Cyprus and then on to Greece so they can get a share of the European natural gas market. We'll see how that goes. Speaking of Israel, an interesting discovery by archaeologists there. They found the gate to the ancient city of Lachish, which is a heavily fortified city, second most important city in Judah, the ancient kingdom of Judah, after Jerusalem, of course. The gate was like, you know, 80 feet by, was it like 80 feet across? And included a number of chambers inside the gatehouses, which were dedicated to various pagan gods. One of these rooms was devoted to a cult that ostensibly worshipped Yahweh, but during the time of Hezekiah, he basically demolished the temple, or at least broke the horns off the temple, the altar. The altar in Jerusalem also had horns on the altar, but Jerusalem, the temple there, was supposed to be the only place that Yahweh was worshipped. And so horns broken off the altar at Lachish. And then to kind of emphasize the point, Hezekiah apparently turned this particular spot, this little mini temple, into a second throne room, you might say, by putting a latrine, a toilet, carved out of stone. Big old block of stone where the king could sit and a hole cut in. So, yeah. So Hezekiah and the other Judean kings apparently dumped on the false gods. Well, other things in the news, but I'll direct you to Skywatch TV for the daily updates on that. Apparently, American troops embedded with the Turkish army are moving on the city of Dabiq, which is the city that Muhammad apparently prophesied would be the site of the climactic battle between the forces of Islam and the forces of Rome. Dabiq really is kind of a nothing, little wide spot in the road, and it's not really defensible from what I've read. The true objective of the Turks and the U.S. Spec Ops troops is a town about 20 miles farther, which was kind of an ISIS stronghold. But Dabiq is the place where Muhammad, they believe, the Islamic State believes anyway, that this final climactic battle would take place. And so things could get interesting because the Islamic State went out of its way very early on in 2014 to take this village, even though, again, no strategic value to it other than it's the place where they're supposed to begin their march toward victorious global jihad. Apparently, U.S. troops, who I presume are wearing sneakers because President Obama promised us no boots on the ground in Syria, and I'm sure he was telling the truth, are only about 3 miles outside Dabiq as I record this on Thursday, the 29th of September. So we'll see what happens over the next few days. Coming up in A View from the Bunker, we just have a couple more sets of interviews as part of our exclusive series on the, from the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference. Coming up Wednesday, October the 5th, you believe it's October already, Dr. Michael Heiser, who is there not as a speaker, but I dragged him up to the interview room anyway, so it's kind of a bonus interview. And Claudia Koenig, I talked to them about their areas of expertise. In Mike's case, of course, the Divine Counsel paradigm and why it's important to properly understanding Christian theology. In Claudia's case, she's just a warrior. When she goes out, she witnesses to anybody and everybody. And both of those interviews got emotional. So you'll hear those, God willing, on Wednesday, October the 5th. Next Sunday, Carl Gallup's talking about his new book, When the Lion Roars, how end times prophecy is being fulfilled, basically as we speak, and why that's important. And then our final interview from the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference, Stan Deo and L.A. Marzulli, that on Wednesday, October the 12th. Hope you'll join us for our Sunday morning, Sunday during the day anyway, Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship. That's at gilberthouse.org. We're going through the Bible in chronological order, so we kind of skip around inside the Bible. But it's an interesting way, and I think you'll get something out of it you might not have gotten before. Neither Sharon or I claim to be Bible scholars. We're certainly not, but we are finding this to be a very fulfilling task. Every Sunday, 2 hours, roughly, an hour each, New Testament and Old Testament, and you'll find those by about midday Sunday at gilberthouse.org. And then every Monday, a new episode in my series, my audiobook series, my novel, The God Conspiracy. Wrote this about 10 years ago, decided to release it as an audiobook by episode. And every week, about another 20 minutes or so from the novel, The God Conspiracy. You'll find that at thegodconspiracy.tk, thegodconspiracy.tk, or part of the package when you subscribe my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. We appreciate you giving us a review, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you find us here on the web. And of course, we appreciate your likes at Facebook as well. That's facebook.com/viewfromthebunker. And we encourage you to weigh in on the topics that we raise here on the program. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House, released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.